Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Sonny Rollins came up fast in jazz. Born in Harlem, raised on the sounds of Coleman Hawkins, Fats Waller, Louis Jordan. Playing tenor sax, he worked and recorded with J.J. Johnson, Bud Powell, and Miles Davis before his 20th birthday. He was brash, creative, and extraordinary improviser. Almost a god, said Miles Davis. And he just kept getting bigger, deeper, living, playing his own way, a way of exaltation. This year, Sonny Rollins turns 80. Most of his peers have passed, but he's still performing, still delivering the exaltation. This hour on Point, a conversation with jazz great Sonny Rollins. You can join us. What's your favorite moment from Sonny Rollins? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Sonny Rollins joins me now from New Paltz, New York. He's a Grammy Award-winning tenor sax legend and composer. He's been performing and recording for over six decades with such greats as Miles Davis, Thelonious Monk, and John Coltrane, to name only a few. The Village Voice calls him famously the last jazz immortal. He launches an 80th birthday tour next month with appearances in Detroit, Chicago, Boston, Seattle, Tokyo, Rotterdam, and many more venues. You can read a list of his upcoming dates at our website, onpointradio.org. Sonny Rollins, it is an absolute honor to have you with us today. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
It's just terrific. Sonny, also with me here in the studio is Bob Blumenthal, jazz critic. He's written for Downbeat, Jazz Times, The Village Voice, and more. Two Grammy Awards himself for album liner notes. His new book, Saxophone Colossus, A Portrait of Sonny Rollins, which he's put together along with photographer John Abbott, will be out in September. Bob Blumenthal, thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure and always a pleasure to talk to Sonny. Hi, Sonny.
Good morning, good day, I should say.
Sonny Rollins, I can't believe it's you. You're here, all this music under your belt, and you're preparing for a great big tour. What, your 80th birthday is in September, and you're rolling out around the world. What's it like going on 80 to prepare for a tour like that, Sonny?
Well, it's difficult traveling these days, as we know.
Sure.
Travelers know. It's very difficult, but the people are always so great, and it's always so wonderful to see people that have appreciated the music, my peers, you know. So it's great. Once I get there, it's really worth all of the hassles.
What's it like, and what's it been like over all these decades of performing, when the curtain goes up and you're on the stage? What's your attitude been, and has it changed over the years? When you're there in the moment, live, saxophone is in your hand, you know, it's time to deliver it. What's going through your mind? And has the experience of that moment changed since you were, you know, I don't know, 19 and doing it in Harlem?
Well, I wish I could remember back when I was 19.
Yeah. That would be nice.
You know, what happens when I perform, what I do is actually what I don't do. I don't think about the music. I just get into the moment. And the music sort of plays itself. So the secret to improvisation, the kind of music that we play, is to not think about what you're doing. The music plays itself. You just want to reach a subconscious level where things happen much, much better, much more than I can think about it. So that's sort of what I did then, I know, and it's what I still do.
Let the music roll. We actually have a recording, your very first recording, Sonny, from 1949, Audubon. This is, you were 19 years old. Here you are with the trombone player J.J. Johnson's quintet. Let's listen for a second. ¶¶ Autumn, 1949, you were 19 years old, and you were not exactly shy right out of the gate, Sonny. I mean, you were really pumping it right through that quintet. Where did you get the, I don't know, the nerve, the courage, the maybe the role model?
Well, you know, I'm a very humble person. I really have a great admiration for my idols. But I always felt that I belonged in the music business and that I belonged playing with these guys, Miles Davis and all these older guys. I was sort of the young guy on the block. But I always felt I belonged with them for some reason. So I guess, you know, I sounded a little brash and everything, but it wasn't because I was too self-centered, anything like that.
Brash is beautiful here. We're very glad you had it. We're glad you brought on the music. Bob Blumenthal, you know this man and his music extremely well. It's such an honor for us to have him here today. But play some for us, if you would, in the kind of universe of jazz, the sound, the role, the character of Sonny Rollins.
Well, I suppose that historically people would put Sonny Rollins in the second generation of modernists, and generations pass very quickly in the development of jazz. I mean, Miles Davis was only 4 years older than Sonny, yet he would have been considered earlier generation because his career began earlier. Mm-hmm. But I think what Sonny brought to the music was a sound and a rhythmic attack that really established him as a personality very quickly. What you heard on that recording was very different from what had become the popular tenor saxophone style. And he didn't do it by rejecting the style. I mean, the popular style of that time was based on Lester Young and a more what would be called a cool sound. But there's a certain assertiveness in what Sonny played and a rhythmic intensity and a foundation in the blues that had been part of jazz but hadn't been highlighted as much at the time. So in that period, he was considered to be introducing a concept called hard bop, or what came to be called hard
successor
bop.
Successor to bebop, in a way.
Well, as a development of bebop, let's say. And then I think as he began to get more opportunities to record under his own name and show his own personality, he began to reveal himself as a very interesting composer. And correct me if I'm wrong, Sonny, but was Audubon your tune?
Yes, that was my tune.
So right from the get-go, he was writing interesting music. He was introducing a sense of humor. He was introducing material to the repertoire that was not considered what one might expect a jazz musician to play. He was introducing influences from the Caribbean and ultimately from other cultures. And he was also introducing a kind of logic to the way he would improvise.
Let's hear a little more. This is 1954. Sonny Rollins, famous Olio, wrote this tune for a session with Miles Davis for the album Bag's Groove. Rollins had three compositions on that album, Olio, Erigen, and Doxy. Here's Olio. Sonny, you're a performer and a composer. How much of this did you see as an intellectual project, and how much was it a direct sort of representation of your emotional life? Was it a cool approach to performing and composing, or was it, you know, this is me?
Well, I would say probably the latter. I tried to compose things that I could improvise on. So the two, composing and performing, they sort of, improvising, sort of melded together, you know. So I think about that, but I also think about melodies and things that might have a distinctive sound and grab the audience, bring them into the equation, you know.
Did you think of, I mean, when people said hard bop, did you say, that's what I want to be? Or did it just come out that way? Did you?
Well, no, I guess it just came out that way, you know.
Sonny Rollins, wow, what a career and what a sound. When you listen back on that now, can you still remember the session? Can you still remember being right there doing it, Sonny?
No, I really can't, and it's really sort of surreal listening to these records. By the way, I never listen to my own music unless I'm forced to, like today.
I've read that. It's just against your grain. We apologize, but the rest of us have a great time doing it. We can't get enough.
But I never really can remember back by the actual days. You know, there's sort of a blur.
Well, it's a lot of music over a long time. The great tenor saxophonist Sonny Rollins joins us today. We'll go out of this section with Blue 7, 1956. Bob Blumenthal is here as well. His big book, Saxophone Colossus, comes out this fall. Listeners, you can join us. Is this your man, your jazz man, your tenor sax hero? And what sets Sonny Rollins apart as a musician, as an artist? Do you remember when he was playing with Monk, with J.J. Johnson, Bud Powell, Miles Davis, before he was 20? 800-423-8255 is our number. Sonny Rollins, please stand by. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking today with jazz saxophone great Sonny Rollins about his legendary life in music, from the Coleman Hawkins, Bud Powell, Miles Davis days to right now. He's about to launch next month on an 80th birthday tour right around the country and the world. Bob Blumenthal is also with us. He's coming out with a big book, Saxophone Colossus, this fall on Sonny Rollins. You can join the conversation. What's your word to Sonny Rollins, still making music, going strong in his 80th year? And what's at the top of your Sonny Rollins playlist? Oleo, Blue 7, Erridge, and St. Thomas. Behind us right here, of course, Surrey with the Fringe on top, Sonny's cover of the Rodgers and Hammerstein favorite from Oklahoma. This track was on Nuke's Time, his first album for Blue Note Records. You can join us at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. What a life. What a sound. What a talent. Louis is calling from Brookline, Massachusetts. Louis, you're on the air with Sonny Rollins.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Today happens to be my birthday, and when I heard this morning that Sonny was going to be a guest on your show today, I told my wife that talking with Sonny would be a wholly unexpected and absolutely wonderful birthday present. So thank you, Tom, and thank you, Sonny, for the gift. I want to ask Sonny a question, but before I do, I'd like to thank him for all of the joy and pleasure that his fabulous music has given me over the years. I've collected Sonny's music on vinyl going back to the 50s when I was a kid growing up on the south side of Chicago. Mm. I first heard Sonny live when I was on leave from the Army, a small little club, I can't remember the name of it anymore, 63rd and Cottage Grove, where he was playing with Jim Hall. Although I don't remember the name of the place, I remember that it cost $1 to get in and $1 a beer, and we stayed until the very end of the last set.
Yeah, great.
Years later, in 2001, my wife and I had tickets for Sonny's concert at the Berkeley Performance Center, which took place just 4 days after 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone wondered at the time if the concert would be canceled, but it wasn't. Sonny showed up, and so did we. It wasn't billed as a memorial concert, but it ended up being both a joyous and a sad one, a concert where Sonny's music and words helped all of us during a very sad and difficult time. The question I have, though, some years ago, the New York a terrific piece on Sonny. Part of the piece told about a guy, I think he was a retired lawyer from Maine, somebody who came to of Sonny's music much later than most of us, but he was so taken with it that he followed Sonny around the country, and he recorded many of Sonny's concerts without permission. He said that he did it out of love of Sonny's music and a desire to preserve it, not to make money off of it. So my question is that I wonder, what's the status of all that? Has Sonny been able to reach some agreement with this fellow such that those of us who love Sonny's music can hear some of it?
Louis, thank you for that. Let me put it to Sonny. Our time is not unlimited here. Sonny, what about it? An attorney from Maine recording you and putting those out? Where's that stand?
Right, right. Well, this was a fellow named Carl Smith, and at one time my wife was very much adamant about this kind of surreptitious recordings. Mm-hmm. And I sort of felt the same way because the musicians were never really compensated and these things were sold. But I came to find out that a lot of these records were just sort of passed around among collectors. Mm-hmm. And so it wasn't a monetary problem. Anyway, I have a collection of recordings, some by Mr. Smith, some by other people that are in my possession, and if I ever get around to it, maybe I'll put some more. In fact, my last album was Road Shows, Volume 1, which was a collection of some of those surreptitious recordings, if I could call it that. Mm. And so there may be more coming out.
Hey, Bob?
Well, I was just going to say that I thought Road Shows had been taken from some of that material, and it's a great overview of what Sonny has done in the last 30 years, I guess. I believe the earliest performance is from 1980, if I'm not mistaken. But it also goes up as recently as a couple of years ago.
Sonny, Louis mentioned having been in Chicago and following you there. You were in Chicago yourself. I mean, in your bio it says early on to get away from the negativity of some of the jazz scene, you moved to Chicago. What was that about? Why'd you go?
Well, I wanted to sort of see what life was like when I was, I think I was still in my teens when I first went to Chicago. And I really had a great time. Chicago is sort of my second home in a sense. Mm. There was so much music there. There were clubs open 24 hours. I met a lot of great people in Chicago. Chicago really has a heart.
Yes,
and,
it does.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really enjoyed Chicago, Tom. And, so it's still my second home.
You had some rough time, ended up in jail. What was that about?
Well, you know, back in those days, substance abuse was sort of the way everybody thought to go. And I got involved with it myself and had to really walk down some dark alleys before I was able to see the light and get myself straightened out, much of which occurred in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And actually, I was able to come out of it in Chicago. So it was
a little Rikers Island, a little Chicago, and you found your way back on the path.
Right, right, right. Chicago. You know, there was a place at that time in Lexington, Kentucky, which was sort of the forerunner of the Betty Ford Clinic, sort mm-hmm. of. And it was a place where a lot of famous people. In fact, I was just reading an article, and they said some of the alumni, if I could call mm-hmm. it that, of Lexington, Kentucky, were Sonny Rollins and Peter Lorre.
So what great company.
I know. I never,
oh, boy.
But I never thought I'd be in a Peter Lorre picture. But yeah, anyway,
right.
It was sort of a place like that. And it was great for a lot of the substance abuse guys at that time.
Sonny,
and,
I
you know.
I'm sorry, I wanted to ask you. We heard Siri with a Fringe on Top there coming into this segment, and it's not the only sort of mainstream song, even very kind of ordinary song you picked up and made magic with. I want to listen to a little bit of another. This is 1957, I'm an Old Cowhand, and ask how you chose to work with this kind of source material. Here's from the Way Out West album, recorded in Los Angeles on his first trip to the West Coast. The cover featured him in a full cowboy getup and used a spare group, only tenor sax and bass and drums. Here's I'm an Old Cowhand. Sonny Rollins with I'm an Old Cowhand there. We heard Siri with the Fringe on Top. Sonny, here's my question. This was still the 1950s. This was not at all an easy time racially in this country. When I listen to a lot of other jazz from this time, it's got a kind of an angry edge to it, and why not? There seems something so open-handed or generous in you picking up songs like this that were very much mainstream songs and giving your artistic stamp to them. I wonder what made you open to that when not everybody was.
Well, Tom, I grew up at a time when the movie theater was what the TV screen is today. Mm-hmm. So every Saturday, we'd go to the movies, and I'd see all of these pictures and the music of some guys I still like, Jerome Kern, all of these great composers. And occasionally I'd see Louis Armstrong in the movies and different entertainers. But I got an appreciation for these melodies, you know, what they call the American songbook, I guess. And that stayed with me, you know, and I still like these songs. And when I play them, it has a special meaning. You know, I'm just not playing it as a piece of music. I mean, it represents my childhood, you know.
Sure. I mean, and who doesn't like the luster of that, no matter what age? Sonny, we have so many fans who want to talk with you. Ira in West Hartford, Connecticut. You're on the air with Sonny Rollins, Ira.
Hi, Sonny. I really enjoy your recording with Thelonious Monk. And I want to ask you, what was the most important thing that you learned from working with him? By the way, Tom, thanks for that great program on Monk several weeks ago.
That was a real pleasure. And Thelonious Monk was your mentor, Sonny. How'd that come to be? And what did you take from him?
Well, Thelonious Monk, you know, during my life, I went to India because I was very much interested in yoga. Mm-hmm. And I was over there for a while, and I realized when I was over there that I had a guru, a musical guru, and I realized, hey, Monk was my musical guru.
This is long before there was a yoga studio on every corner or everybody used the word. What did it mean that he was your guru?
Well, you know, Monk, of course, was about 14 years or so my senior, but he took me under his wing, so to speak. He really liked my playing, I'm very happy to say. And Monk once said to me, you know, Sonny, without music, the world would be blah. I said, right, there's no question about it. So I was very much of a kin with Monk. And, you know, so when I got to India, I was thinking about my life all over in the States and everything. And it came to me. I said, yeah, Monk was really my guru.
Your trip to India was one of several sort of famous sabbaticals you took in life, where you really withdrew, and not just for a couple of months, but for years at a time. What would spark those journeys away from the limelight?
Well, Tom, I was trying to find perfection in my music. I was trying to find perfection as a human being. I was trying to find perfection, period. And that sort of covers the various sabbaticals that I took.
You spent a lot of time in one of them, of course, famously out on the Williamsburg Bridge. It's a great image in American history, American jazz history, of you blowing away there in the night. Was that a perfection as musician or perfection as person pilgrimage that time?
Basically music, but it turned into person also. I used to walk across the bridge there, and I used to do, it was good physical exercise.
Yeah.
And I used to do some chinning exercises, mm-hmm, on part of the bridge abutment there. So, but it was basically a musical journey that I was on at that time, but it turned out to be everything. You know, I stopped smoking during that time. I had been smoking a lot, and I stopped smoking, so it turned out to be everything.
What a great image, Sonny Rollins doing chin-ups on the Williamsburg Bridge, and out of that comes the bridge. We'll hear some of that at the end of this segment. I want to get a little bit of... you were political at times. Here's the Freedom Suite, 1958. This is just a little part of a 19-minute suite. Wrote this after trying and failing, Sonny Rollins did, to rent in a white upscale neighborhood of New York City. The liner notes, he wrote, say that the black man has been, quote, persecuted and repressed. No kidding. Here's from the Freedom Suite. Sonny Rollins, what was it like when you took that more political stand? What was the reaction from your fans?
Well, I sort of grew up with a grandmother who was very much of an activist. And, you know, she was very... And I am naive enough to feel that there is such a perfect world possible where... content of your character more than color of your skin, you know, this kind of stuff. I always naturally felt that. So I undertook this composition, Freedom Suite, and I'm glad to say that it, when I look back, it sort of was the first one of that sort in modern jazz anyway.
Did you imagine when you were composing that there would be, in your lifetime, a black president?
Well, now you've got me into another subject. I guess I never did, actually, to give you the short answer. Obama... You know, although I think it was great that he got to be president, but he was not really my candidate. My candidate was Dennis Kucinich, because I thought that he had the right ideas. Obama was a very, very sort of a centrist guy, but it ended up being the melanin was the message.
Sonny Rollins, you're great. We want to hear more about that. We got to take a short break right here. Jazz, great. Sonny Rollins is with us today from New Paltz, New York, and with me in the studio, Bob Blumenthal. We'll go out of this segment with a little bit from that time he spent on the Williamsburg Bridge on the Lower East Side of Manhattan, here at the bridge, 1962. You can join the conversation, 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back with Sonny Rollins. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with jazz saxophone great Sonny Rollins about his legendary life in music. Pictures in the reflection of a golden ball behind us right here from 1973. This is from Sonny's album Horn Culture. Features electric instruments and thick instrumentation. It's sort of along the lines of Miles Davis's Bitches Brew. You can join the conversation this hour, 800-423-8255. What sets Sonny Rollins apart from Coltrane, Charlie Parker, Coleman Hawkins, Lester Young, you name it? And where does jazz go now? Sonny Rollins is about to set off on his 80th birthday tour right around the country and the world. He'll be in Boston, Chicago, Seattle, Tokyo, Rotterdam, and right on, you name it. You can see the full list of venues at our website, onpointradio.org. He joins us today from New Paltz, New York. And Bob Blumenthal is with us, author of Jazz, An Introduction to the History and Legends of America's Music. You know, he's got a big book, Saxophone Colossus, on Sonny Rollins coming out this fall. And, of course, we've got a legend with us right here. Bob Blumenthal, Gary Giddens writes of Sonny. He says, the main thing is, in Rollins' best work, he says, I hear this kind of inspiration, this kind of euphoria. The main thing is that there's a sense of well-being about him.
Well, I do think that great music is uplifting. And even when it's going to dark places and more serious concerns, it can be uplifting because it's created in a spirit of a positive spirit, a spirit that we can do better, that we can improve. And that to hear Sonny Rollins at his best is, I think, an inspiration to everyone to try to duplicate that in what they do.
But, you know, Sonny, I mean, there's great music which can sound, sometimes Coltrane sounds like an exorcism. It's absolutely beautiful and amazing. But, you speak more in terms of exaltation, not just in music, but in all art. What do you mean by that, Sonny? Hello, Mr. Rollins. We lost the line to Sonny Rollins, but we'll get him right back here.
Okay.
That word exaltation, Bob, I feel it all the time. I read it from Sonny Rollins, but you just hear it in the music.
No, and I think that when you see him perform, it also is reinforced because it's just a very positive encounter that you have. I remember he once said to me that his purpose wasn't to make people happy, mm-hmm. pure and simple, mm-hmm. because just being happy to, without having a foundation in something appropriate isn't enough. But to be uplifting and to be more positive and to give a more positive view of the world and life and what the potential is out there. And I think that's what you hear. You hear someone striving to find that better place.
I mean, you wrote the book, about the jazz history and legends. He was one of the younger ones, and he's still with us. And many had untimely earlier ends, but here he is, even now. How do you look back on him? How do you look at him in that pantheon? I mean, where does he stand? What does he stand for?
Well, greatest ever. I mean, I learned a great lesson early on. One of the first live experiences I ever had was hearing John Coltrane, and I left and said, "This is the greatest music on earth." And fortunately for me, a month later, I heard Sonny Rollins live. And said, "Oh, there is no greatest music on earth. There's just great music." And so I wouldn't want to say the greatest. I would say that if anyone made a list of the 10 greatest, he would definitely be in the list. If anybody made any short list, he would be there. And I do think that that you get part of it. It's kind of the same spirit that Louis Armstrong carried with him when mm-hmm. he performed, the same spirit that Fats Waller carried with him when mm-hmm. he performed. And often some of these musicians, and even Sonny, because of his sense of humor, might not be considered serious, if you will. But there's something in that positivity. It's kind of like the old notion that artists have to suffer and have to always mm-hmm. be displaying, their darkest hours to be at their best. Life isn't like that. That's part of life. That's not all of life.
But if joy isn't serious business in this universe, I don't know what is.
Well, and exactly. It's you need the complete picture. And I think that artists like Sonny and Armstrong gave us the complete picture.
His improvisation, he was always famous for. Here's a lengthy kind of trademark solo improvisation by Sonny Rollins from his live album, Don't Stop the Carnival. This is Autumn Nocturne, 1978. Autumn Nocturne, 1978. It doesn't get better than that.
Well, it's but it gets as good quite often. That's why wow. people still love to hear him perform.
Well, our line is just nicked out to Sonny. We're trying to get him back right now, but let's hear from our listeners. Randy in Sanibel Island, Florida. Randy, you're on the air.
Hi. Sonny's always been a great influence on me as a sax player also, but I wanted to know how he interpreted performing with the Rolling Stones for on the Waiting on a Friend and some of the tunes off of that album there.
That's an entirely different genre here, but yes, he got hooked up with Mick Jagger and Rolling Stones and Waiting on a Friend. I think this is from in their 1981 album, Tattoo You, became a top 20 hit in the U.S., and there he was, uncredited for the Stones on that album, but a lot of people will remember it from popular music. Let's listen here, Rolling Stones with none other than Sonny Rollins coming in. Rolling Stones with Sonny Rollins, 1981. Sonny, I think we've got you back. How did that happen? How did they rope you in? And why no credit, sir?
Well, you know, actually, I hate to say this, but I was actually said, wow, Rolling Stones, that's sort of beneath what I should. My jazz fans will kill me. So I said, no, I don't want any credits. I'll just do the record.
just let it be there. Just let everybody figure it out on their own. Bob?
It's hard to disguise the presence of Sonny Rollins, though, credit or no credit.
Yes, I think that is very, very true. Sonny, I'm glad you're back because everybody's got questions for you. Jay in Kingston, Massachusetts. Jay, you're on the air.
Hi, Sean. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Mr. Rollins, thank you very much, as the other gentleman said, for all the joy you've brought us all with your wonderful music. You're brilliant. And I think you're well qualified to answer the question that I have, hopefully. I'm curious about why younger African Americans, for decades now, seem to have had very little interest, in jazz and blues, which, to my understanding, are the only original American art forms. And it's just beautiful music, and I don't understand how it got replaced with some of the popular music that the younger African Americans are listening to today. It seems like when I go to a jazz or a blues club, it's mostly pale-skinned folks there. What's your take on that, Mr. Rollins?
Well, remember, this is a huge, huge country, and I think America is an experiment. So there's still factions. You know, I remember a lot of the jazz clubs we used to play at. Eventually, we had more white people coming in. And then some of the black people left because there were more white people appreciating the. I mean, there are all of these little subtexts going on why young black kids, you know, feel, oh, we'll do this or we'll do. Because it's, I mean, there's, but it's silly reasons like that, which, you know, harm the general culture in that everything shouldn't be appreciated. I think that hip hop, all of this stuff, is under the jazz umbrella. I think it's all jazz. I think jazz is just a music force. You know, the real sense of what jazz is really the freedom and the, you know, yet the sense of right and wrong. It's jazz is what America is in a sense. But I think a lot of, there's more that I could say on this subject, but I know we don't have that much time, but, you know, something like that.
But I wonder if, do you think that there's going to be the kind of musicianship out there in the country that you grew up in the midst of, around jazz, that would be familiar to, you know, your peers in that heyday? Is that still going to be there, or is it just going to be in the archives, just in the old recordings? And does it matter, Sonny?
Well, I think I grew up at a time when it was really a golden age. We had, I don't know if you've seen that jazz photograph, that famous jazz photograph by Art Kane that had all of these different generations of jazz
and
people.
Everyone's there in Harlem all at once. It's kind of, you can't believe it's true.
I know. But it shows that there was a point when everybody at that point was sort of a golden age. You could hear Willie the Lion Smith. You could hear Ornette Coleman. You could hear everybody. Everybody was sort of playing and creating at the same time. Now, I believe that the future is bright, and music is so unlimited that, you know, we never know how these things are going to come about, but they will come about in some unexpected way.
Mm. Let's get a call from Nashville, Tennessee, and James. James, you're on the air with Sonny Rollins.
Rollins, I cannot tell you how excited I am to actually get to talk to you and ask you some questions. I've been a huge fan of yours. I'm a musician, a guitar player, but I've studied your music and gotten to play your tunes. And I mentioned that one of my favorite all-time albums is The Bridge. And as that is a reference, my question is, when you're constructing an album or planning an album like that or any album, As a theme, or how do you choose tunes based on, is it emotional content or more melodic, or are there themes throughout the albums? How does a process like that take place, if you can even talk about that just a little bit?
Sure. Sonny, James in Nashville wants to know.
Well, James, sometimes there's such a thing called a concept album, in which I try to have all of the music relate to that concept. And then there's other times, of course, overriding that, there's always whatever I am playing at the moment in my repertoire, which sounds acceptable to me and hopefully to my fans. So that also plays a large part. But there's also a concept album. Sometimes I make concept albums and I try to tailor the music to a concept. But overriding that, it's always what I am playing and how well I'm playing, how well the group is playing, how everything is fitting in our performances. And that's really what's going to be in the on the album. But, you know, different albums, I've made a lot of different albums, and some of them are concept albums, and some are albums which just represent what Sonny Rollins is able to get out of his horn at that particular time.
Here's from Global Warming, speaking of concept albums, eco-conscious album, Global Warming, 1998. Sonny. Your Caribbean roots, very clear right there, and also global climate politics. Are you still focused on that? Where is your sort of focus of, I don't know, concern or work in the world right now?
Well, I'm very concerned about human beings taking personal responsibility for what they do. For instance, say if you're driving along the road and you throw out, and you're eating something in your car and you throw the wrapper trash out. Mm-hmm. This is really the essence of what global warming is. And it's a very personal thing, but it's also something that man in general has to kind of think about, just soiling our homeland, you know.
Yes, indeed we do. Wow, you give us so much to feel and to aspire to and to think about, Sonny. It's such an honor to have you. I can't wait to see you get up in your 80th birthday tour and do it one more time. Saxophone at the ready, sir?
I'm ready.
To hit the road.
I hope.
Oh, I hope we see you when you come to town. I hope you have a great tour right around the world. It's been a real pleasure and honor to have you with this hour. Bob Blumenthal's big book, Saxophone Colossus, on Sonny, comes out this fall. Bob, it's been great to have you here.
Thank you. And it's also John Abbott's book, the great photographer and a great friend of Sonny's and mine.
Absolutely. And Sonny Rollins, good luck with the tour. Our huge thanks to you for being with us today.
It's really been a great pleasure being with you. Thanks a lot, Tom.
We'll go out with Nishi from Sonny Rollins, 2006. Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thank you.